our entire net worth is in Flashpack. So when it went under, it was really scary, like really, really scary.
Welcome back to Series 11 of 40 Minute Mentor, your pocket-sized career mentor on a mission to raise aspirations and inspire the next generation of category-defining founders. From purpose-led entrepreneurs to world-class investors and Olympians, you'll learn firsthand from today's successful leaders on what it takes to be brilliant, all in just 40 minutes. Today's 40-minute mentor is Radha Vyas, co-founder and CEO of the award-winning adventure travel company Flashpack. Flashpack is on a mission to create 1 million meaningful friendships across the globe using the power of travel and technology. The platform connects solo travelers in their 30s and 40s to enjoy authentic, stylish, and rewarding adventure together. Flashpack's journey hasn't all been smooth sailing, however. Although the company grew every month since its inception in 2014, reaching a £20 million turnover with a team of 60, when COVID hit, Flashpack and the travel industry were hit the hardest. Following an incredibly tough time, Flashpack 2.0 was born, and Radha and her team have since been more successful than ever before. I'm really looking forward to diving into Flashpack's journey in full detail today and finding out more about what Radha's vision for the future is. So, Radha, thank you so much for joining me today on 40 Minute Mentor. We've met a few times, so I've been super excited about this conversation. How are you, firstly? How's 2024 started for you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Super busy. Really excited to be on this podcast, so thanks for the opportunity.
Ah, well, the pleasure is all mine. And we always like to get our guests warmed up with a few quickfire questions. So if you don't mind, can you finish the following sentences after me? Number one, the most memorable day in my career was when?
Probably when we relaunched the business, so Diwali 2021.
Okay, a good way to remember it. Amazing. The celebrations all round. One word others would use to describe me is?
Resilient, maybe insanely resilient or insanely brave, maybe.
It's a good one. And based on what I know about the story that you're going to tell us, that is very apt based on all you've been through. So thank you for that.
Maybe just insane, to be honest.
I think we're all a bit insane founders, aren't we? To kind of put ourselves through the mill like we do every day. But it's part of the fun, isn't it? The adventure. My biggest failure to date is...
Well, that's easy. When the business went into administration during COVID, definitely the biggest failure I've experienced.
Yes. And I would say I'm looking forward to hearing more about the story. I'm not, because I know it was an incredibly stressful time, but I think there's going to be lots of learnings in there for our audience. And we'll come on to that a bit later. I measure success by?
I think I measure success by how motivated, energized and optimistic I feel each day. And if I can reach a kind of 80 to 90% level in those three things, I feel like I'm winning.
Love that. Yeah. Somebody once said to me about energy givers versus those that suck energy as well. Like, it's also to do with the people around you and the activities you're doing. And I use that myself as well. Like, if something is giving me energy, that's a really good sign. And if I'm feeling really tired and lethargic and a bit stressed, then I sometimes need to sort of take a step back and go, why is that? And is this something I should be focusing my energy on? Awesome. And final quickfire question. If there was one thing I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be...
Oh, that's easy. Just how hard and inequitable it is for female founders to raise money.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you for sharing. That is, not unsurprisingly, come up a lot on this podcast. And we're really hoping, I guess, one of the reasons we do it and really want to promote a wide range of particularly female founders is that it's just starting on the back foot, aren't you, by such a long way. And I hope that's changing, but there's still so much work to be done. So hopefully by sharing your story, we're going to inspire even more female entrepreneurs to start businesses and hopefully get lots more investors as well. Thank you, Radha. It's great. You've already teased our audience with some of the big things we're going to talk about in that, which is a wicked way to start. But before we dive into all things Flashpack, I'd love to learn a bit more about your younger self and particularly those sort of early career aspirations, because I think it's funny how entrepreneurship creeps up on some and is destined for others. So do you mind telling us a bit about your upbringing and what did you want to be when you were younger?
Yeah, I think, there were so many things I wanted to be, including a fairy and a princess and all those things too. But I think I definitely wanted to be an entrepreneur from a young age. I was exposed to kind of business ideas and entrepreneurship from a young age because my parents were really enterprising. They always had a side hustle, kind of a catering business. And my sisters and I were recruited to help make, you know, hundreds of puris and things like that for big weddings and serve up food. So that definitely gave me a strong work ethic from a really young age. And then travel was also a massive part of our family life. My parents were incredibly adventurous and we were fortunate to start traveling from a young age. I was on a plane from the age of 2.5. My parents took us backpacking around India for 3 months. And then they even sent my sister and I off to Africa, aged 7 and 9. I was 7, my sister was 9, on our own, on a plane, on our own to Kenya for 2 months to visit family we'd never met before. And it was an incredible experience. And I think that really cemented my love for travel. It's like very vivid. That whole experience is very, very vivid in my mind. Being on the plane alone, my sister getting in trouble and being in Africa for 2 months with my cousins. And that, I think it gave me a kind of sort of unshakable confidence in myself. You know, it was that message of my parents trusted us to just go off and do this on our own. So that, I think in those two things in tandem have kind of led me to where I am today. I remember talking about business ideas from a really young age. I was trying to convince my parents to give me a bit of investment to buy a pony so I could give kids around our local neighborhood pony rides and charge for it. So I remember feeling most alive when I was talking about business ideas. But I was also a bit of a, you know, I was a bit of a kind of travel bum, I suppose, when I was younger. I lived in France for a year before I did my after my A-levels, I lived in France before I went to university. And then I lived in Madrid for a year during my university course and went to university in Madrid. And then after university, I went to live in Chile for a year and traveled around the whole South America. And then when I was about 25, that's when I really started to get serious about, okay, I want to find my big business idea. And I came home and started exploring that.
Wow. Love that. Love that. Sounds like you had an amazing childhood. And
yeah, I feel really privileged. You know, my parents are still super adventurous. They still go off backpacking, you know, with their like one suitcase and go to kind of Vietnam or Myanmar or whatever. So I feel really lucky to have had that exposure when I was younger. And I definitely try and give that to my daughter now. But when I came back from South America, I then tried a few different business ideas. This was back in kind of 2026, 27. So just before like the whole big startup boom, right? Before I really understood what the word startup meant. There weren't many careers in startups then. So we were just kind of feeling our way through. I set up a few different business ideas, which failed for various reasons, but it's led me to where I am today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd love to learn a bit more about that, because I think you ran your own consultancy business for a number of years, and I'm sure you would have learned a lot from that experience. So do you mind telling us a bit about what you did? What were some of the biggest takeaways and lessons from that? And particularly, I guess, the things that have helped you now that you are, you know, a very successful and experienced CEO and co-founder. How did that experience or those experiences lead and help you to sort of where you are today?
Yeah, so I'm a very mission-driven person. So working in the third sector just made absolute sense for me. And fundraising gave me that satisfaction, kind of helped me balance my business aspirations plus my philanthropic aspirations too. So that made complete sense to me. I learned so much from fundraising about business. I learned how to kind of pitch ideas, storytell, get high net worth individuals to kind of back a cause. And it was fantastic. I set up my consultancy because I realized early on that I just didn't fit the mold of a typical employee, and freedom. I think I just needed more freedom. Freedom is probably my most important asset in my life, above money, above anything else, just the freedom to kind of explore what I want to do, where I spend my energy and my time. So I set up my consultancy. And I learned a lot. It wasn't the big scalable business idea that I was craving. And I kind of understood that quite quickly. But it gave me that opportunity to understand how to do my own taxes, you know, how to set up a following, set up a website. I learned a bit of coding. I learned how to write newsletters and create content on social media. And I learned all the basics of business. So it was great. And I met a lot of really interesting people in the space too.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing grounding, albeit maybe a slightly alternative grounding to maybe others that have come on the podcast. But I guess, yeah, fundraising, the skills you've learned from storytelling, pitching, as you said, to high net worths, that's hugely transferable. So it's really cool to hear a sort of different experience in that regard. I believe the idea for Flashpack was born on a first date with your now husband and co-founder. So I'm sure our audience would love to hear all about the origin story of the business. And yeah, I guess how you first met.
Okay, yeah. So it's a bit sad. I was in my early 30s and this kind of idea of finding my big business idea was kind of escaping me. I was single and I just felt like I hadn't had life sorted. At the time, I was looking for a holiday and stumbled upon this idea of group tours, which was a super polarizing concept, and it just intrigued me. But in tandem, I decided to sort out my love life. And this was pre-Tinder, by the way. So I went on Match.com. Remember Match?
Match, yeah.
And in true kind of, I guess, my style or founder style, I saw it as a project, you know, and I diligently filled out my profile so the algorithms would match me. And after 2 weeks, it did. It matched me with Lee, who actually lived around the corner from me in Brixton. So we went on a date and we spent the entire night talking about travel and business. After a couple of, he was a photojournalist. He had some insane stories about traveling the world and the first person to find Gaddafi's body and all that kind of stuff. So it was a really, really fun evening. And then after a few glasses of wine, I accidentally divulged this business idea I had around group tours, and I'd kind of stumbled upon this concept of traveling with strangers that felt super uncool and quite polarizing and a bit naff, to be honest. And I didn't know anybody my age who'd ever done a group tour before. I don't know if you've ever done one. I had never done one before setting up Flashpack. So I started talking to him about it and he immediately got it. He was single in his 30s and he had just been trying to convince his married friends to go to Thailand with him. So he completely got it. And it's a bit sad, but we started actually brainstorming our first product ideas that night. And then obviously the date went really well and we hit it off. And after a few weeks, we continued kind of talking about the business and developing our relationship. And Lee said, you know, I'd really like to explore doing this with you. And I said, well, this is a huge risk, isn't it? Because we've just met and we're thinking about setting up this business. And we decided that we would go on a recce to Sierra Leone. And that if we could survive Sierra Leone together, then we could probably survive setting up a business together. And we were laughing about this the other day. It was so crazy. Like, we could have gone to Thailand. We could have gone to Bali. We went to Sierra Leone. And it was a really challenging adventure. And, you know, there were so many instances where we had to negotiate our way out of things. Like, we ran out of money. We almost got mugged. Like, there's all this stuff happened. And we survived it and enjoyed it. And so we decided to set up the business together.
That is honestly the greatest founding story ever. And it says so much about both of your like adventurous nature, I guess the kind of risk appetite that you need to start a business, that you throw yourself into such a big commitment after not knowing each other for very long. But wow, what a success it's become. I know, not without challenge, and we'll come on to that, but absolutely love that story. I guess I'd like to ask you, you've obviously founded a few businesses and had a few, you've failed ideas, you've had successes. With this one, what was the point where you were like, okay, this is the right time to do this? Was there like a moment of clarity? And I'd love just to understand, for any early stage founders listening to this, like, what were some of those first steps that you kind of, you had this idea that you'd been talking through and then you started to turn that into a reality? What did that actually look like?
Yeah, 100%. So like I said, I had spent quite a number of years trying to set up different business ideas that hadn't worked for various reasons. And I think that trained my mind to find solutions to everyday problems, right? And I started training my mind around what are big scalable ideas, which ones aren't. And so when I stumbled upon this idea of group travel, it was that aha moment, and I was ready to kind of seize it, right? And Seneca, in the words of Seneca, luck is opportunity meets preparation. And that's exactly what happened in this instance. I'd spent so many years thinking about business, training my mind, that when I saw this idea and this opportunity, I knew it was the right one. I went to the British Library, and started researching it and saw all the trends going up and to the right, right? Solo travel was growing, in tandem, single households were growing, people were feeling lonelier, friendship was declining, like all the trends were going in the right direction. And everyone used to say to me, oh, you know, follow your passion. If you want to set up a business, follow your passion. But because I was multi-passionate, you know, I'm passionate about food, I'm passionate about so many things, I went off on these different tangents. But when I saw this idea and this opportunity, I knew I was the right person to do something really special in this space, because travel had been in my veins since I was born, essentially. So yeah, it was that big aha moment. And I just ran to it, you know, I just ran towards it as quickly as possible because it was what I was waiting for.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. And was there like, I guess in some ways, you know, travel, so you're so experienced, but creating a business like that, like was there the first step in terms of this is what this could look like? And we started to think it through, like, what did the actual steps look like? Because I feel like where do you start with something like that?
Yeah. So that night with Lee, we started brainstorming kind of what the business would look like. And we decided we wanted to be, because of the people Lee and I are, we decided we wanted to be this super like cutting edge travel company, taking people to places they'd never thought of going to, hence Sierra Leone. When we set up the website, we invested our savings. We had about £15,000 worth of savings. We invested that. We learned how to set up a website. And I'm a great believer that you can become a Zulu in anything, right? If you invest enough hours, you can become an expert in anything. And that's what we did. We just Googled everything, learned on the go. We set up a website, and our first trips were Sierra Leone, a horseback adventure in Uganda, a Vespa trip in Spain, Chile, and Brazil. We had 5 trips. And then it took us 6 months to kind of realize that actually that people don't want to go to Sierra Leone and Uganda when they haven't yet been to just Vietnam or, you know, or to Thailand. And actually this cutting edge concept wasn't going to get us the traction we needed. So we had to pivot the business. So we made some early mistakes. I don't think we quite understood the notion of the concept of MVP back in those days. But essentially, we just went to loads of industry events. We started researching the competition. We started looking at what we could do different, what we could do to differentiate ourselves, to cut through the noise and avoid competing in the red ocean with everybody else, right? And we figured those things out initially, created initial concept and strategy. And that's how, you know, looking at competitors, all our competitors were going quite budget. Their level of hotels was quite low. Their level of experience is quite low. Customer service was quite low. And we just decided to do everything the opposite to competitors, right? So we went super premium hotels, premium experiences that you can't source anywhere else, high touch customer service. And that's how we started to get our kind of how to cut through the noise and started to get traction.
Amazing. I'm sure lots of our listeners will have come across Flashpack before, but I'm conscious we've sort of teased them with lots of bits of the story so far, the origin story. But what is the business today? Like, how does it work? Who's the ideal customer? Because I'm sure there are people listening to this like that would really benefit from being a customer. So yeah, do you mind telling us a bit about what the business is today?
Sure. So Flashpack connects solo travelers in their 30s and 40s to go on amazing adventures all around the world together. So 90% of our customers come alone, and you travel with 13 other like-minded, truly like-minded people. And this is where we differentiate from all our competitors that assume that just because you're going to Vietnam, that you'll be like-minded with others. We don't assume that. We do a lot of work to ensure that you're traveling with people just like you. And we actually guarantee a positive group dynamic on every trip. We realized that the industry was completely underserving and ignoring people in their 30s and 40s. And so that's why we focused on that demographic. And they were also ignoring the fact that who you travel with is our customer's biggest pain point, right? Nobody wants to travel with a bunch of strangers that they're not going to get on with, or they have to make kind of inane small talk with for 2 weeks. You'd rather stick pins in your eyes. And so that's where we doubled down. And that's our core value proposition and our kind of customer guarantee that you will travel with people you like, that you get on with, that you resonate with. And actually 90% of our customers say they make friends on a Flashpack trip. And that's our mission. Our core mission is to create 1 million friendships through adventure travel. And we believe that there's no way to fast track friendship than travel, and especially adventure travel, right? So now if me and you met, and we have met, and we, you know, we're like-minded, we're both founders, it would take us like a year of going out for dinner and drinks. And we know this, we're part of the same founder community. You have to invest a lot to create friendship, but actually you go to South Africa for 2 weeks with people who are like you, and that friendship is created very, very quickly.
That's so true. All the travels that I've done, it's incredible how, especially when you're thrown into sort of sometimes uncomfortable, slightly stressful, ambiguous situations, but it's amazing what it can do and bring people together. I absolutely love that. And I love the mission. We touched a bit about the roller coaster you've been on. You alluded to that right at the very beginning of this conversation. But yeah, before we come to COVID and all of that stuff, how was the first 6 to 12 months of getting the business up and running? How did you gain that early traction? There was obviously like more established competition at the time. Would love to sort of find out what worked for you in those early days, maybe what didn't, and what some of those biggest lessons were, you know, in that first year.
Yeah, the first 6 months were absolutely grueling. So we were quite naive. And like I said, didn't really understand the concept of MVP. So invested this money in a website, created these cutting edge products. And then nothing happened for 6 months. The phone rang. I mean, we had a physical phone back then, and the phone rang once. I answered it and it was a wrong number. So, I mean, that gives you how well it was going. You know, to convince people to spend £2,000 plus with a company they'd never heard of, that had no social proof, you know, it was very, very difficult. So we had the dreaded conversation, should we give up? And it was super, super depressing. It was 2014, early 2014. And Lee was reading a magazine or something, I can't remember now, Mashable or something like that. And he saw a picture of Christ the Redeemer statue in Brazil being fixed because it was damaged from lightning. And the World Cup was coming up in Brazil. You may remember in Rio in 2014. And he said, look, I've got an idea how to get more eyeballs on our website. And we were running out of money. Like we were on our last kind of couple of £1,000s, right? And we didn't really know where to go, but we had this gut instinct that this was going to be a really big business as long as we could get enough eyeballs on the website. So he said, like, look, I'm going to go to Brazil and doorstep Archdiocese and convince him to let me climb the Christ Redeemer statue and take a selfie from the top. And selfies were trending in 2014. And so was the World Cup, right? Because you remember Rio was getting loads of bad press because of they were pacifying the favelas. And I didn't even know what this meant. I didn't know what viral meant at the time, but I said, okay, like we've got nothing else, just go for it. So he flew to Rio. He did just that, convinced the Archdiocese to let him up. And the Archdiocese was like, you're crazy, but go for it. And gave Lee the statue, the keys to the statue. And he climbed up the statue. And not many people know this, but in the middle of the statue, there's a mosaic heart. It's really beautiful. And he climbed up and then he climbed up to the shoulder and then popped his head out of the top of the statue's head, and he took this selfie from the top.
It's incredible.
Yeah, and the view is incredible, and it's, you know, stomach churning because it's so high. Anyway, we sat on it for like a month because we thought if anybody finds out, if BBC find out, they'll send Gary Lineker and nobody's going to care about Lee Thompson, right? So we sat on it for a month and then we released it just before the World Cup in June. And it went insanely, insanely viral. I still think it might be one of the most viral selfies in the world. Most viral campaigns in the world. We were covered by every single news and media in the world, from like Germany, Russia, like just everywhere. Lee was running around on American TV doing interviews. I was chained to my desk, emailing every journalist in the world saying, yes, you can have the picture, but please give us a backlink to our website. And we also had a video that you had to go to our website to view the actual video footage of him climbing the statue. And we got 4 million hits to our website in a week. And then that's how we got our early traction.
That is so cool.
So we started getting monthly bookings.
I love that.
It's crazy.
Absolutely love that. Well, yeah, but fortune does favor the brave. It's like a phrase that comes up over and over again here. But like, I just love the boldness of it, the ambition. I mean, Lee must be one hell of a negotiator to get the diocese to allow him to do that, and also just to have the confidence to use that as like a channel. I think it's just so ingenious. And clearly off the back of that, the business would have exploded. So were you even ready for that? Like that suddenly from sort of almost 0 to 100, how did you manage all the interest that was then going to come your way?
Yeah. So we weren't ready for it. I think my biggest regret is that actually we didn't realize how viral this would go. And we only had 5 trips on our website, right? So we lost a lot of customers on the back of that. We had so much interest and we didn't have the product ready. So that was a big regret. But we did start getting monthly bookings and we did start getting traction and we got off the ground and we started employing our first employees to deal with the interest. So yeah, I think my biggest regret was I don't think we quite believed in how viral this was going to go and just didn't have the right setup for it. But I mean, we thought of the campaign and executed it within a month. So we wouldn't have really had that much time to get ready for it anyway. But yeah, I think if we're going to do it again, we'd definitely be ready for it this time. And sometimes I do wish, I'm like, oh, I wish that opportunity would come up again now.
Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant. And of course, not everybody is going to be able to come up with something like that and have that virality and that kind of golden bullet that we all would love to have to kind of have explosive growth. But there's clearly some learnings in there for founders. So if there's any early stage founders listening that may be struggling to get traction, do you have any tips or thoughts on whether it's guerrilla marketing or anything else, that just some things that you would encourage them to think about maybe to break the cycle that they're in that's maybe not quite getting them where they want to be?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the biggest lesson learned from that time is that constraints are good, right? And we still operate the business in this way. Financial constraints, resource constraints, they're all good because they force you to think in innovative ways. And they force you to think of solutions that you'd never think of. Like if we had raised like a big seed round, we'd never done that. We'd never have done that selfie. Like we'd never have thought of that. We would never have had the confidence to do it, right? We would just throw money at Facebook marketing or what have you. So first of all, like change your perspective and realize that actually constraints are good. And then play to your strengths, right? Lee was a photojournalist, so he naturally understood how to storytell and he understood the power of photography. And so we played to those strengths. So I would just ask founders to consider that, like sit down and think about where are your strengths and where can you kind of double down and maximize your skills and knowledge that you already have rather than trying lots of new things.
Yeah, it's such good advice. And it really resonates for me because when we were pivoting our business away from working with bigger corporates to focusing fully on startups, we created this podcast because we were like, we have been doing it, but the market doesn't realize that we're doing it. It's really hard to get our authentic voice across and that we are really different to other search firms out there. And we've kind of consistently tried to come up with something slightly different, but it sometimes just needs you to be brave. And sometimes those innovations are not going to work, but you've got to keep going to stay relevant and see what works. Coming on to COVID, I kind of feel like I don't want to talk too much about COVID, but it's such an important like part of your story. Clearly a very challenging time for so many people, but particularly for entrepreneurs in the travel industry. And I know it would have been a very stressful time for you, but do you mind sharing with our audience just a bit about how the business was impacted and also how you then came through that very stressful, difficult period?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I'll start from just before pre-COVID. We were flying really high. We were just about to kind of achieve our first 20 million GMV that year. We had a staff of about 60, 65 people in London. We were raising a Series A, a big Series A round. We were being inundated with offers from VCs. I mean, we could get into a room with a partner with anyone we wanted, Index, Excel. Like Excel was sending me baby gifts in the post. I just had a baby. We felt invincible, quite frankly. We'd gone around doing teaser meetings with about 30 different VCs around London, and we had chosen 4 to take into the next round. I had American VC saying, oh, look, you know, we'll fly to London and visit you. And this was about February time. They said, oh, well, there's a bit of a ban on travel because of COVID, rolling their eyes, but you know, we'll come to London next week. Like nobody was taking COVID seriously. I remember we were in a meeting with Excel and the partners asked Lee, what keeps us up at night? And Lee said, COVID. And he just shrugged it off and laughed and said, well, okay, yeah, fine. What else? You know, nobody was taking it seriously, but we could see it coming around the corner. And we were just trying to get the raise done really, really quickly. We'd chosen 4 VCs and we were just about to go into DD. This was early March. And then Trump closed the borders on March the 13th, 5 p.m. UK time. I'll never forget it. And that was it. Revenue dropped 95% overnight, like that, gone. And all the VCs went quiet. Everything fell through. We suddenly had a situation where I was creating a war room And we had customers, the phones ringing off the hook. We had customers in Costa Rica, in Sri Lanka, stuck in Morocco. We had customers who didn't want to come home. We had customers who were panicking. Everybody was asking for a refund and revenue had just gone. And we had to start making some really, really quick decisions. And we had never been in this situation. We had 4 years of pretty much, you know, we were just 4 years of absolute like astonishing growth. I mean, at some points we were 3-4xing our business, right? I'd never dealt with anything like this. And I suddenly had to go from peacetime founder to wartime founder. And that was like a shocking awakening and transition for me. We created a war room and started like talking every hour to a senior management team of like, okay, this is what we need to do next. This is what we need to do next. Inevitably, all our funding fell through. We had never raised a round, an institutional round. We had only raised £250,000 in 2016 from some angel investors, and we had bootstrapped the company to that level of growth. So we had no one to turn to. So every kind of scheme that was out there, Future Fund, like didn't apply to us. We couldn't, you know, we weren't profitable, so we couldn't apply for C-bills. My mental health was kind of tied to the news. Every single day, we're just watching the news to see if there would be a package for the travel industry. And it was just crazy. We carried on having meetings with VCs and with competitors who feigned interest in our business to kind of understand what our secret sauce was. But, you know, everyone, they were all managing their own fires. And so nobody had the ability to invest. Nobody was investing in travel. So after 6 months of trying to save the business, we realized that, look, this is not going to happen. And we started putting the business into administration. We had to make all our staff redundant. And we put it into administration on Diwali 2020.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. 4th of November 2020.
I mean, it's just awful, especially given you'd bootstrapped, predominantly bootstrapped. I mean, you've achieved so much. That must have been like gut-wrenching and just so painful to see your baby, like stuff completely out of your control as well. I'm so sorry you went through that. What are the biggest learnings from that experience, particularly for anyone else that we know that there are crises around the corner all the time for founders? Hopefully not too many sort of global pandemics, but there are things that always crop up. So what advice do you have for anyone that might be navigating difficult challenges right now? And maybe any lessons that you took from having to make those difficult calls? Yeah, would love to just hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. They say that all the best businesses in the world have nearly died three times, right? Like it's an inevitable journey you go on when you're creating a high growth business or any business, really. It's hard. I would say, I think my most valuable piece of advice would be get advisors around you that have no vested interest in your business. When you're going through crisis, you don't know who to trust, right? Like whether it's cash flow issues, whatever it is, right? Your latest funding round has fallen through and suddenly you've got 2 months of runway left. You don't know who to trust. There will be vultures who are trying to take advantage of your vulnerability. There'll be competitors who try and take advantage of your vulnerability. Get advisors that you trust. I would also go as far as to say those advisors should be seasoned founders who kind of understand it. I had a very good friend and who is now advisor to the business, Neil Ambler, founder of Bankt. He was my like safe place. You know, I would go to him and say, these are challenges I'm facing. Like, what am I not seeing? He gave me perspective. He gave me confidence. He just gave me pep talks when I needed it. He helped me to calm down when I was in a state of just panic and overwhelm. And that I wouldn't have got through without him because I didn't know who else to trust. And as CEO, especially, it's very, very lonely. Like, of course, I've got Lee. And that's great. If you've got a founder, that's great. You've got someone to lean on. But as founders or as CEO, sometimes you can't even talk to your most senior management team about some stuff. You can't always be transparent about everything until you've figured it out. So it's a very, very, very lonely time. I think that would be my key piece of advice. And find those advisors now before you're in crisis and build that relationship.
It's such good advice. And for me as a solo founder who's found it lonely at times over the last 11 years, we have a board of advisors that are independent and it's been an absolute game changer. Just as founders, the community we're in has been invaluable at times. And And this is partly why we've created this podcast, is that it's almost like an extension of that through people's stories, but couldn't agree more about the importance of that. There's so much more I wanted to cover, Radha. So I'm going to, I want to make sure we quickly touch upon the fact that you and Lee are co-founders, you are husband and wife, your parents, like that is a lot. And given all you've been through, quite remarkable. Just talking about, I think it's really important, particularly if there's any other couples that are in business together or thinking about doing it. How do you navigate all of these, the harder things? How do you distance work and have your own like time? Like it must be so difficult. Do you mind just sharing a bit of an insight into how those dynamics work and any learnings you've had for that for anyone in a similar situation?
Yeah, like, look, I'm not going to deny it's hard, right? And Lee and I have been doing this for 10 years now. So we work together seamlessly and we hardly disagree anymore. Like, well, our vision, our strategy, everything is very, very aligned because we've been doing it for such a long time. In the beginning, it was super, super difficult. We put some processes in place to help us navigate kind of tricky situations. So what we did is we had areas of the business that we owned. And we said, look, okay, you have ultimate veto over those areas of responsibility, right? If we disagree, we operate on a disagree and commit basis. We discuss something, but to ensure that the business keep moving forward, if it's your area and we disagree, like we each disagree and commit and keep going. But for really big things, we don't do that. Like we both have to be completely aligned and have complete conviction behind what we're trying to do or the strategy we're trying to deploy. So that's how we still operate essentially. But like I said, we hardly have a disagree and commit situation now, really. It's quite rare because we've been doing it for such a long time. But the other thing, hard thing about working with your partner is that you're taking enormous financial risk, right? Like our entire net worth is in Flashpack. So when it went under, it was really scary. Like really, really scary. So you have to consider that very carefully and what your safety net is if that were to happen. The other issue is that when you're going through good times, that's great. Like there's no one else you'd want to celebrate that with, right? You're going to work with your best friend every single day. It's awesome. But when things are bad, and they are often bad and stressful, there's no one to kind of lift you out of that because you're both in it. So when COVID was happening and we were both super stressed and depressed and confused, we couldn't really help each other because we were both just in that state. So there are some things to kind of consider there. And, you know, it's hard for Anya, like poor Anya, like she has to kind of compete for attention. Like Lee and I talk about work all the time. We're now really conscious of it. Like we realize that she sometimes she'll like knock over a glass of water or something to get our attention if we're talking quite intensely about Flashpack. And we're really conscious of that now and try to not talk about Flashpack in her presence and just be really present with her. But there are sacrifices you make being in business with your partner, but it can also be absolutely awesome. And I wouldn't change it for the world, but you have to talk about your strengths and weaknesses and what you're trying to achieve. And you need to be able to communicate really well with your partner to make it work.
Yeah, that's really great advice. We've covered some of the harder parts of the journey, but the reality is that you have rebuilt Flashpack to be an incredible success post-COVID. You've raised £5 million to lead an expansion into the US and you've grown the team to, I think, over 70 now. You've raised from top investors like Jamjar Investments. I mean, what an incredible turnaround and story. So firstly, huge congratulations. I guess I would love to hear sort of why you decided to go. I mean, most people would say, given all you've been through, you are well within your rights to go off into the sunset, do something else, work for somebody else, like leave all that stress behind. So why go again? And how have you approached the build second time around? Are there any really key learnings or just things that have really made a big difference this time?
Yeah, great question. So why did we go again? I think we did consider starting a completely new business. I mean, at this point in our lives, it'd be difficult to work for somebody else, right? After 10 years of building our own business, I think you're probably slightly unemployable now. And also the travel industry was completely decimated, right? We didn't even know who could employ us. So that was quite a scary time. We did think about starting a new business, but we just realized we loved Flashpack so much. And it sounds a bit cheesy, but it was our first child, right? And I think your just parental instincts just come out, like they just came out and there's nothing you wouldn't do to save or support your child, right? And I think we just went into like parent mode, like, right, we just have to do whatever we can to save our baby. To make that decision to go again, you have to love your business. We had to remortgage our house to save it and all of that stuff to take on that much risk. That was a reason we went again. But key lessons learned were well, raise money when you don't need it. Like, I will never bootstrap a business again. Don't bootstrap a high-growth business. Like, just don't do that. It's so hard. I now understand why many people don't do that. So we raise money. We've raised about 7.5 million over the last 2 years. We are very cash generative, as you can tell from the fact that we bootstrapped in 1.0. We don't really need the money for runway, but we raise money just in case another COVID comes along so I can sleep well at night, but also for key investment areas like tech and the US. So key lessons, like, raise money when you don't need it. And we definitely do that. And then our kind of approach to 2.0 now is the product and strategy hasn't really changed from 1.0. We were always focused on the US. It was always our biggest market. It's even our UK secondary now. US is our biggest market. So the strategy for growth hasn't really changed. Our focus hasn't changed. We have absolutely doubled down on our mission to create friendship. But in terms of how we approach the core business, like, one of the fundamental things we're focused on is diversity in the company. In 1.0, we lacked diversity. And that was something I was a bit ashamed of. Like, when Lee and I had all this time during COVID to kind of think about what we did well and what we didn't do well, actually the lack of diversity was one of the things that kind of surfaced for both of us that we felt like we hadn't done well. In 1.0, honestly speaking, I just thought it would happen by osmosis. I was a female Asian founder. Like, it would just happen, right? And it didn't just happen. And I understood that it wasn't just easy for me to create diversity because I'm an Asian female founder, that I had to be very intentional about it. So the very first thing we did when we set up Flashpack 2.0 was trailblaze a transparent pay policy to eliminate gender gaps, ethnicity gaps. We now have employed a kind of blind application process, the idea I stole from Rachel Carroll from Koru Kids around not looking at CVs and asking everybody to fill out 3 questions when they apply for a job opportunity, so that you're eliminating unconscious bias. And there's lots of other initiatives that we've run. And I'm so proud to say that actually over 60% of our team are now female. Over 50% of our leadership team is female. We do need to do better at C-suite. There's only me at C-suite that's currently female. So definitely that's the next thing I'm going to deal with. But from director level below, the entire leadership team is over 50% female. We have 40% of our employees identify as ethnic minorities. 4% of our employees have a disability. And we are really, really proud of that, right? 33% of our employees last year received a promotion. So we're very focused on the culture. I mean, what we achieved in 4 years in Flashpack 1.0, we've achieved in 2 years now. So we're getting faster, right? And I definitely believe that's due to the diversity of thought and diversity of the team.
It's absolute music to my ears. As a search firm in this space, working with high growth startups, we're constantly banging the drum about the importance of thinking about this early and being really deliberate in going after creating more diverse and inclusive companies. And it's amazing to see the evolution and how successful the business is becoming for being even more diverse. And I think that's a really important story for us to tell to any other founders or aspiring founders listening, because it really does make a difference. And your team now, you know, is growing. Hiring is a really difficult thing to do. That's, I guess, why we have a business. It is hard. And it's often the thing that a lot of founders say is the most challenging part of their role. So what have been your learnings from hiring over the years? You've hired a number, you know, over 100 people over the years. So what have been your biggest lessons there? And I guess linked to that, around evolving a culture, I'd love just to hear your thoughts on what the Flashpack culture is now and how, when you're hiring, you assess for that.
I think my biggest lessons from 1.0 were that your culture isn't about how much fun your employees are having. And we had the ping pong table, we had the office dog culture, we had loads of benefits, and it was very fun. But I quickly realized that that's not what is ultimately important to employees. The reason people come to work for you is to do meaningful work, is to develop their careers. They want to work in a psychologically safe environment. They want to work with the best people. They want to achieve and grow their own career ambitions, right? That is a big lesson learned from 1.0. What we do now is we hire people who are completely aligned to our values. I think in 1.0, I used to do culture fit interviews. And that sort of has a choking effect on diversity, right? Because what does culture fit mean to most people? It means, who are you going to get on with down the pub? And so now we hire according to our values. I mean, we live and die by our values, right? We hire, fire, and promote according to our values. We don't always get it right. We have made some mistakes. Inevitably, you are going to, right? And I feel like a founder, there are some things I learn really well, and there are some mistakes I just continue to make. I think it's just, you know, there's going to be a percentage of hires that you make that aren't going to be right, because it's just the interview process is flawed, right? Inherently flawed. And you don't know if your environment is one in which somebody can flourish, and they don't know that until they start. But now we really assess everybody according to our values. It's a strong part of a performance framework. We talk about our values all the time. We make decisions based on our values. And that has been the most important thing for our culture. And I think our culture is very, very strong now. Everyone understands what our values are. We have a very psychologically safe environment where people feel supported. And if there is any kind of toxicity brewing, we go out, the leadership team go out and kind of stamp it out very, very quickly so that everyone feels...
It's so important.
Yeah, exactly. Because it can spread, like one toxic person can spread like poison. Like very, very quickly. So we stamp it out. We're a very transparent company. So we talk about these things all the time in all hands. We are very transparent when we release people from the business, and we try and do it with as much dignity and grace as possible. But we do release people, right? If they're not right, it's very important to do that and make that call early on for that person and for the company.
Yeah, I think it's kinder to do that. If you see it coming down the line, it's better to do it faster, but in a human, empathetic way. Because as you say, the wrong apple in the, you know, can really disrupt your whole culture and actually is not beneficial for them or the rest of the business. So I love what you're saying. I think there are so many lessons in there for our listeners. And I'm really grateful that you shared that, because culture is everything and talent is the game changer to succeeding. And if you get it wrong, it can really have a really detrimental effect to your success as a business. We're sadly at our wrap-up questions, Virada. I could talk to you for hours. There's literally so much more I'd like to ask, but we'll have to do another round sometime. But this is 40 Minute Mentor, so I have to ask, if you could be mentored by anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I think it would be Sarah Blakely, founder of Spanx. I just think she's absolutely incredible. She's dynamic, energetic, and I would just love to go out for dinner with her and just pick her brains about how she created a unicorn business.
Love that. Great answer. I think that's a first. I'm surprised it's a first, but yeah, she is truly inspirational. So that's a great one. And our penultimate question is a question roulette from our audience who know that you're coming on and have selected some questions. So can you pick one, two, or three, and we will see what they've chosen for you.
Oh, I'll pick three.
Three. Okay. You've traveled to some incredible places. Where is next on your travel bucket list, and where would you return to in a heartbeat? That's a great question.
Great question. So I've returned. I'm not generally somebody who goes back to the same place twice, but I've returned to Sri Lanka twice already and absolutely love it. Like, I love Sri Lanka so much. I describe it as India light. So it's got all the charm and the great food and everything of India, but it's just more relaxing and smaller. So I would return to Sri Lanka. And what's next on my list? Well, I think next on my list would have to be a safari. I've done quite a few safaris, but I really want to do a safari with my daughter. Or I would love to take her to Japan, because I think Japan would just blow her mind. And it's a great destination for families. So I think either a safari, like maybe Botswana. I've never done Botswana, or Japan.
Japan is on our family bucket list. My daughter Sienna, she's 8. And that is one that we are sort of, is definitely in the works for the next couple of years. I'm super excited about that. I've always wanted to go on a bullet train, see the blossom. Just kind of all the robots as well, and the food, of course.
Yeah, no, it's great for kids and it's great for adults. Yeah, definitely speak to me before you go.
Yes, I definitely will. You will now be my go-to for all travel experiences. And finally, what is the one piece of career advice that you would like to leave our listeners with today?
The one piece of advice I'd like to leave everyone with is just learn to get stuff done. So whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur or you're looking to apply for a job at a startup or wherever, right? Just learn to get stuff done. I've been banging on about this for a number of years, but Barack Obama also just, there's a viral post recently with Barack Obama giving the same advice. And honestly, it's like that virtuous cycle. The more you learn to get stuff done, the more impact you have, the more opportunities that come your way. And again, in the words of Seneca, you know, luck is preparation meets opportunity. And I really think this is a way to kind of create that luck in your life. So that would be it.
Love that. Perfect place to end it. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your inspirational story of resilience and a lot of success. I'm really excited to see the evolution of Flashback over the years ahead. I know it's going to be unbelievably impactful for so many lives and create so many friendships, which is just so important. So Radha, thank you for being here and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity too.
Thank you so much. Cheers. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I really hope that you found it useful and inspiring. If we have left any questions unanswered, or if you have any feedback or guest recommendations for future series, then please make sure you get in touch on info@jbmc.co.uk. I often get asked by listeners how you can help us spread the word about 40 Minute Mentor. There are two simple ways you can help. Firstly, share this episode on your preferred social media platform, and LinkedIn is probably where I'm most likely to see it. And you can also leave us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every share on social media and review left on the podcast platforms really helps us to get 40 Minute Mentor in front of new audiences and share the power of mentorship even further. Thank you so much for your ongoing support, and I look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday for even more pocket-sized mentorship.